Welcome to the Rising Laterally podcast.
Each episode, you will learn something fascinating so you can bring big ideas to your small talk.
Your growth is our growth. Listening to these episodes, subscribing to our weekly newsletter, engaging our posts on social media, and sharing our show with your friends and family is deeply appreciated as we work hard to expand this platform. You can also visit our page at buymeacoffee.com to contribute what you think the show is worth.
To the folks who are taking this step, we can't thank you enough. Look for the link in our show notes for more details about how you can support and follow us.
And now, please enjoy this episode.
Joining us from the Canadian province of Saskatchewan, today's guest is storyteller, author, and wildlife veterinarian, Dr. Jerry Haig. Jerry was born in Kenya, educated in Glasgow. Upon graduation in Scotland, he moved back to Africa, where he lived and worked for over 10 years, bringing his expertise to Uganda, Namibia, Rwanda, South America, Cameroon, among many other countries. When Jerry and his family made the move to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan in 1975, he took up a post as a wildlife veterinarian at the University of Saskatchewan's Western College of Veterinary Medicine. Jerry's career-long experience with wildlife has spanned over five decades and four continents. He has worked on species ranging from elephants to wild dogs and polar bears to moose, and of course, reindeer, which are the subject of Jerry's forthcoming book, Reindeer Reflections, Lessons from an Ancient Culture. Jerry, thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you guys. Thank you.
Welcome.
It's great to have you. Well, we certainly would like to discuss the book in this conversation, but before we get there, let's travel back in time to your early years. You were born in Kenya, and in your writing, you mentioned that as a child, you were a Boy Scout in England. So can you give us a little perspective on when you and your family made the move across continents and paint us a picture of your early years?
Well, as you said, I was born in Kenya. My father was serving in World War II in the King's African Rifles during the Italian campaign up into Ethiopia. Then when they left Kenya, they went back to Britain and then ended up living in Scotland, which is where I went to university, as you rightly said. And that was very interesting times. I became a keen outdoorsman, fascinated with wildlife. And 3 days after I graduated from veterinary college, I was back in Kenya. As you say, I spent the next 10 years there, initially working in general practice and gradually moving over to the wildlife side of things and working with rhino and elephants. And as you mentioned, actually all five of the so-called charismatic or great species or whatever you want to call them. Charismatic species is one term that's used. Mm-hmm.
And what are all five of those?
Oh, all five of the charismatics, rhino, elephant, lion, buffalo, and leopard.
Wow. That's exceptional. Was that what drew you back to Kenya? I did want to ask you that. You were born there and you kind of turned right back around after you got your education. Was the wildlife there just more interesting to you?
No, I think it was just a wish to visit my birthplace, and I got a chance as a job as an intern. And started off, as I said, with general practice, dogs and cats and cattle and horses. And then the opportunities started to arrive for wildlife work. I think my first wildlife patient was a giraffe, a lame giraffe.
For people that aren't veterinarians, working with domesticated animals versus working with wildlife, how different of an animal, no pun intended, is that?
Well, that first giraffe gave me a lesson straight away as to how you had to think. Because here was this enormous animal. I had to figure out how to deal with it. And it became a question of realizing it was just a greatly overgrown cow with similar foot size, similar stomach anatomy, same number of vertebrae in the neck, which some people have hard time believing. It's only seven, same as us, and yet the length of that guy's neck. Just a question of transposing on education and also learning as you go along. You have to do that. You don't have a clue about what a rhino does for his life until you start working with them.
Right. Yeah, as you look back on your career, Jerry, you treated so many different animals. I'm sure you came into contact with so many different maladies. Is there a specific case that you look back on as maybe the most rewarding, or the resolution of that case was most rewarding? Any highlights from your 50-year-long career as a wildlife veterinarian?
Well, I think rhino are my favorite creature simply because that was the first major case other than that early giraffe. And I actually had to do a very unusual treatment on that rhino, which is one that sticks in my mind and I've written about, when this rhino had been beaten up in a pretty violent struggle. And unfortunately, she had had the horn of the male right up her rear end and everything was
covered.
Absolutely. So she couldn't urinate. She couldn't take a dump. She quit eating. She was in tough shape. And the park warden called me out to see if I could help. And I took one look at this creature and realized the only thing I could do was back rake, as they say it. That's a euphemism for going up the rear end and pulling all that fecal material out. It's just processed grass, if you think about it. So it doesn't smell. And pulled it out for a while. It was so hard, it almost, you know, felt like digging concrete. And then I gave her a 4-gallon enema.
Oh, okay. My God. That's a lot. It's a lot of liquid.
And you'd be happy to know I did not take a photograph of the results.
And how did it work out for her?
Oh, fine. Next day, all well and good, you know. And then I had cases with lions, George Adams lions and things like that. But that's the one that sticks in my mind as the first and pretty dramatic case. Dealing with an unusual animal, much the same as you might have done with a horse.
Yeah, interesting.
Since we're talking about this and your experience with different animals over the course of 50 years, were there any times where you felt like you were in pure danger?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you're in danger if you're dealing with a cow who's going to kick your head in.
But I didn't realize that a cow can kick forwards and backwards until I read your book.
That's right. Don't mess with me if you want to mess with my udder and it hurts. Horses can be darn dangerous. They can bite and they can kick like fury, as we all know.
But did you ever feel like your life was going to be threatened at some point? Like, did you actually face off with an animal in a way that your survival instincts kicked in?
I don't think so. I think I may have been just dead lucky or too stupid to realize what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, elephants can be pretty hairy, but of course we use drugs to control them. Lions, pregnancy checking a lion, as I quoted, and you need to think about, if you're pregnant chatting a lion, you need to be equally, if not more certain, what's going on the other end.
Right. Took me a second, but I see what you're saying.
Okay, yeah.
And speaking of drugs, I know that in your book you mentioned that there was a cocktail that you would use, and part of that cocktail, fentanyl would be mixed in. And I found that interesting because now fentanyl has a complete different meaning and aura to it. So I just think it's interesting how one drug or one component can be used in a way that helps animals out, but at the same time, it's killing humans.
That's right. It was actually developed for human anesthesia. It's extremely effective, especially with the guys who developed it early in heart problems, because it's ideal. It doesn't damage the heart or the heart rate. And I used it in a lot of different animals, rhino, elephant, lots of different sort of antelopes. I've tested polar bear, moose on this continent. And I met the people who early developed it. It was developed in Belgium. And as you say, it was a fantastic drug and now used in cocktails. But the key is what you just pointed out. Terrifying misuse by unscrupulous. I better not use the words I'm really thinking. People who, why are they killing their clients is the second question.
Right.
By cutting it in. It's frightening what's happening.
As bad as it is to say from a business perspective, it makes no sense. It's terrible.
Well, I had recent surgery and they gave me some fentanyl. I mean, that's like 6 weeks ago.
Wow.
It's still in use, but of course, not quite the same dose as you might use for a rhino.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine that would be lethal for humans.
Well, a lot of people.
Yeah, no, too many. We've talked before on the podcast about how things are becoming too medicalized and there's, a lot of overreach in our treatments of things that could be treated with more natural means. So that's definitely an example of that. And we actually talk later on about your experience with the shaman because that dovetails into that theme nicely. But before we get there, let's get kind of a bird's eye perspective of your journey to Mongolia. You actually took several trips over there over many years. That was the subject of your book. You were lending your veterinary expertise to the Tsautan reindeer herders in the lowlands of Mongolia. For those who haven't heard of them, they're a relatively small tribe whose name literally means people of the reindeer. You quoted Gombat, one of the Tsautan veterinary technicians who had accompanied you in your travels, as saying, quote, "The reindeer is the most important thing in our lives. If there were no reindeer, we would not exist," end quote, which is a testament to how important that species has become to the tribe. They actually milked their reindeer, which I thought was quite exceptional. Can you give us a little bit of a backstory on the Tsautan community and tribe and how their culture became so enmeshed with the reindeer?
Well, one slight problem that was lowlands. No, they live in the foothills at the higher mountains, even above the tree line in the northwestern part of Mongolia. So they're very high up. They're nomadic. Mm. And it's probably the oldest domestication of reindeer anywhere on the planet. At least 3,000 years ago, they were probably domesticated. They're completely nomadic. They live in a thing that very much resembles what we know here as a teepee or a wigwam, with a series of poles in a pyramid, and they wrapped around with canvas and stuff like that. They have summer camps and winter camps, and sometimes also move on in fall. There's, of course, the reindeer need constant feed. And if they stay in one place too long, the wrong time of year, they get into trouble. But these guys know precisely where the next step is. There are not very many people. There's about 44 families, I think, in the entire mountain region. And they rely totally on their reindeer. They can ride them. My first vision of that was a young boy, a young teenager maybe, who threw a blanket over the back of a reindeer when we were riding up in the mountains. It's the first one I'd seen close up. Wasn't tethered, it was just grazing.
Wow.
And he threw this blanket over it and then threw his leg over and got up and they started to move.
Unreal.
No worries at all.
Part of the family.
Yeah, one you of the mentioned- things... Oh, go ahead, Arjun.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned that these animals were domesticated roughly 3,000 years ago in that northwestern part of Mongolia. Just to put perspective around that, it's estimated that dogs were domesticated by humans about 15,000 years ago. Yeah. But Jerry, can you just extrapolate a little bit and tell us about your own fascination with animal domestication?
Well, it's something that's gone on, goodness knows how long, as you suggested, 15,000 years for dogs and lots of other species subsequently. Why? Well, we use animals. That's the way it is. And they use us. If we think about the modern ones, they couldn't survive. I mean, you take a vaccine and put it back in the wild, that'd be the end of it in pretty short order. You'd either starve to death or get eaten by something bigger. So there's a real conjoining of lives there. But the why and the how is what fascinates me about animal use, if you like. So, you know, cattle have come down from what was a wild beast many thousands of years ago, maybe 8,000, a thing called the aurochs, which was deadly dangerous. And horses, you look at the ecology and history of horse use, you can think of almost any of our domestic animals and think back to when they emerged from that completely wild status, because humans figured out a way to domesticate them. I'm not talking about the individual calf raising. If you think somebody who picked up a white-tailed deer fawn in the grass, which you shouldn't do, by the way, but because they're actually their mothers leave them. That's normal. White-tailed deer fawn hides until the mother comes back to feed it. But good, well-meaning people who pick up a white-tailed deer fawn thinking it's been abandoned and take it, hopefully, to a conservation center and not home, and start to bottle feed it. And so they domesticate it. No, sorry, they tame it. Quite different.
And all right.
A tamed white-tailed deer is fine if it's a female. If it's a male, once it goes into puberty and starts to grow antlers, it can switch almost overnight from a gentle, loving, pick-your-pocket kind of creature to somebody who'll kill you. Mm-hmm. The testosterone levels have risen, I don't know, at least 1,000 times. And he'll skewer you with his antlers if he gets the chance. I know people who've that's happened to, and of course, if you follow the media at all, people do get killed almost every year by white-tailed deer bucks. that they body raised, and then they go nuts during the rut. That huge testosterone surge, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And can you unpack that distinction between domestication and taming? I thought the process of taming was really interesting from an evolutionary perspective, taking two animals that are exceptionally tame within a species, breeding them together, and then taking their offspring and breeding them once again with exceptionally tame animals within that same species. But how does that differ from what we would formally call domestication?
Well, I think it's the other way around. Mm. I think domestication is a very long process if it's done properly. That's why the Satan got to the point where their reindeer do anything you can think of. You can ride a book, and as you suggested, almost anything. Use them as herding animals, pull sleighs, and domestic reindeer in the Russia have four different characteristics. Some of them have shorter faces, others shorter legs, different coloring, all that sort of stuff has evolved over the thousands of years. With taming, you just take a foal or a puppy, something like that, maybe a coyote pup or, like you said, a white-tailed deer fawn, and you tame it. But you haven't changed it in any way other than just taming it for your purposes. Mm. You want to domesticate it, it's not an overnight process. So cattle were domesticated from that aurochs starting 8,000 years ago, and gradually people selected the quieter ones for different purposes. So you've got the Jersey cow, which is a complete pussycat. That's behind the ears, right?
Yeah.
You have the Texas Longhorn or beef breeds. You don't want to mess with them. And then think of those fighting bulls.
Yeah.
Domestic, but they're sure as hell not tame.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, interesting. And in thinking one of the anecdotes in your book too, you talk about how the bull reindeer can sometimes sneak into the pen of cows, and the wild bulls can impregnate domesticated cows, and the offspring are not domesticated enough to live with the other domesticated reindeer. So it's kind of an interesting example of nature versus nurture, and how introducing wild DNA into a species, domesticated species, you know, that offspring becomes unable to get along with the others in their way of life. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Because they can't tolerate being handled by humans because of that input from the wild bull.
And it's amazing because when it comes down to cows and bulls, again, pulling from your book, it comes down to seasonality and day length in terms of how they can reproduce. And I thought that the overview that you provided of the reproductive cycle of cows and bulls was something that maybe is worth sharing over the next minute or two.
Sure. Well, in the fall, if we start at that point, the hormones begin to run. The ovaries become active in the females. And as we mentioned already, that testosterone spike just goes amazing. And I've studied elk in great detail, where the semen quality in the summer is virtually nil. Looks like a bunch of car wrecks in a wrecker's yard. There's no quality, no ability to do anything. And then come the fall, late summer and fall, the quality of the semen rises rapidly until it's what we've seen and read about and moves very quickly. And now that animal is fertile. So the cow has come in to estrus, she's cycling, the ovaries are functioning. And at a certain day when the ovaries are ready to go and ovulate, the bull smells it out. He knows what's going on. So he goes after the female and she's not quite ready. So there's a phrase I've used and others as well. She needs to be impregnated the day she'll get pregnant. Mm. So she waits for the bull to do his thing. And the phrase might be, she runs away until she catches him.
Mm, that's a great line.
He moves quite a long way away. And then it's a shorter and shorter distance until she stands for him.
Yeah.
And then I sometimes wonder about human biology. Whether the babies run away until they catch the guy.
Yeah, it's parallels.
And while all this is going on, there's an antler cycle that's taking place as well. It's just fantastic. It's just fascinating to think about how it has to be so precise.
Exactly. Many people have seen a deer in velvet. That's a very soft sort of, feels a bit like velvet when you touch it. starts growing in the spring and grows very rapidly, sometimes known as the fastest growing tissue of any animal. And it can grow centimeters a day. You watch it grow. And then come late summer, that velvet gets rubbed off, it dries up, and suddenly you've got that hard antler that everybody knows about and the trophy hunters love. And at that point, you've got an animal that will do one of two things. Mainly, it's show and tell. So if a subordinate bull shows up, and the one with the antlers in reindeer, they're enormous. They're longer than the animal stands, over a meter, what that's
really. Wow.
Yeah, huge.
Wow.
Suddenly, if a younger bull shows up and the big guy shows us that enormous rack, he's telling the younger, again, I can't use the phrase I'm thinking of, but go away.
Yeah. And sometimes, as I read in your book, they can get tangled with each other and either die of exhaustion or just make themselves vulnerable to predators. And it was just quite an image of like two bulls competing for a suitable mate and then ended up locking antlers with each other. And that's the end of their life story. It's just kind of, I guess, a sad irony to that.
You're absolutely right. And I have a dramatic incident, that not in this book, but in another one I wrote, of two white-tailed deer that got in exactly what you're describing, same-sized antlers. The antlers locked, and luckily a conservation officer knew I was at the university and knew I had to deal with these things, and he called me out, and there I arrive, and there's a dead deer on the ground that coyotes have already started to eat, and a live one trying to pull away.
Wow.
The fentanyl. I gave this guy a jag of fentanyl using a blowgun, and he went down quietly, and all was good. I cut the antlers away.
Oh, wow.
Given the antidote, and he got up and ran off, and then we took the dead one, and the conservation officers took it somewhere, I don't know where, and so that was a classic example. And if that hadn't happened, those two animals would have both died.
Yeah, sure. That's an extraordinary story. Wow.
Yeah,
and they lose their. People may have heard that you cut their antlers off and said, oh no, what a tragic outcome. But the bulls lose their antlers at the end of every season, which I thought was really interesting too.
Yeah, they do. It's a standard thing. Again, what's happened is that testosterone level we talked about has dropped way back. Another cellular activity takes place and the antlers naturally fall off. Hmm. And the intriguing thing about that is the big bulls, they don't need 10, 15, whatever pounds of antler on their head when they're not trying to do a show and tell. Why not get rid of them? And the younger bulls, which start later in the fall, keep their antlers a bit longer because the cycle is slightly shifted until they become adult, and then everything goes according to the normal, what you might say, pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, doubling quickly back to the topic of domestication, I was just curious, you kind of laid out that process of breeding quieter animals together with each other, and over time you can domesticate a species. Theoretically, could you domesticate any species, or given all the different animals you've seen, are there some in your mind that would be impossible to domesticate?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I mean, that classic example I quoted of the foxes, that Russian guy who did that extraordinary experiment where he took wild foxes, trapped them, and then bred them and chose the cubs the quietest from each litter and got them to breed each other. So from two different litters, they'd have a quiet female and a quiet male. And in seven generations, they'd taken completely wild foxes to the point where they were somewhat domesticated. They would wag their tails and accept people. And later on, that work's continued. And now people have more or less tame domesticated foxes, which rely on humans for food.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. That must be quite a sight.
Yep. Very pretty. I bet it's a beautiful looking animal.
Yeah.
Whether it's socially acceptable by us humans is a different question.
I also wanted to ask you about the backstory of Rudolph and his red nose. You talk about the exceptional nose of the reindeer and how it acts as a heating and cooling mechanism for air that's going in and out. Can you tell us a little bit about that little known history?
Yeah, sure. It's not actually red. Reindeer have either gray or white noses, but really good science has followed up the reason why reindeer are amazing to survive in that terribly cold environment or very hot situations, that the end of the nose has got this extraordinary heat exchange system, I suppose is the best term. Think about a car radiator where it brings the cold air in and warms it up by the water circulating as it comes through that belt in the front. And reindeer do the same. In the really hot weather, they can cool the air as it comes in with this incredibly intricate supply of blood vessels in the bottom of the nose, the end of the nose. Hmm. Now, in the cold, they can't afford to lose that heat. It's 37 degree temperature in their body. And if Celsius. They got physical, they'd be in terrible trouble. Hmm. So as they breathe the warm air out, they have to try and keep as much of it in their bodies as they can. Mm. So what happens is, again, in that incredibly intricate blood supply, they can preserve the heat and keep it back and breathe out air that comes out into the atmosphere much colder. And what's happened, what recorded, is 37 degree, or more or less 37 degree, that's centigrade. I can't do that in Fahrenheit, sorry.
no wrong.
Body temperature has dropped to as much as 21 degrees coming out. So they've saved 16 degrees of warm weather for themselves. And there's one extraordinary example where they got it down to 6, from 37 to 6.
Crazy.
Which is incredible. And yeah. So it saves them. And if they can't do that, they can get into serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that 37 degrees Celsius is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Thank you very much. I probably knew that in my schoolboy days.
No worries. But it's, you know, it's interesting to think that the reindeer can legitimately just put their whole entire system in reverse.
Yep.
And dump their heat.
Yep. Well, actually, when we refer to the red, as we agreed, it's not a real thing, but there's a wonderful experiment written up in a seriously prodigious medical journal called the British Medical Journal, where this team of scientists decided to find out more about the function of this amazing network of capillaries and vessels in the nose. And they took a reindeer and walked it into a lab that's got tens of thousands worth of valuable research equipment in it by the look of the movie. You can actually see there's a video, you know, there's a YouTube video of this. Mm. And they put it on a treadmill and they start the treadmill very slowly and begin to speed it up. And they use what's called a thermal camera on the end of the nose. They're showing a light that we can't see. Mm-hmm. And as the speed increases and the reindeer needs to get rid of heat, lo and behold, with this thermal camera, the nose goes red.
Mm. Wow. So,
and they put this in the scientific article. They use Rudolph in the introduction and in the summary at the end. They referred to reindeer, Santa being able to fly his reindeer over the northern sky because of the red nose. And then you need to look carefully at the scientific article. You can guess when it was actually published. In the December issue.
Oh, that's fun.
Sometimes
you got to have fun with your serious work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Usually you're not allowed to use adjectives or descriptions of the senior or anything in science articles.
Yeah.
Pernickety. But this one was fun.
No, that's awesome.
And just to put the Santa story in perspective a little bit, you know, again, I gathered it from your book that this actually evolved in 1823 when there was a poem that was published that actually had no reference to Rudolph or the red nose. Absolutely. And then it gained more popularity around 1964 when NBC started airing the cartoon, and now it's one of like the all-time Christmas classics.
Yeah, not only the cartoon, but the song itself. Somebody, I think it was anonymously, actually added the word, the whole line about Rudolph. And then, as you said, one of the great, Chris, I think there are three famous songs that have lived through time. There's White Christmas, and what's the other one? And then, of course, Rudolph.
Mm-hmm.
It's there and we're stuck with it. And, you know, it's a pretty song. Kids love it. We can accept it as adults.
Yeah, it's a classic. Oh,
yeah, it sure is.
Wouldn't want to be in a world without it. Well, Going back to your travels in Mongolia, I wanted to highlight a specific story here that I thought was really fascinating. One morning you wake up and for some curious reason, your forearm has begun to swell and it's so painful that you can't even hold your bowl of tea, which as a tea drinker like yourself, that's a problem. Fortunately, one of your companions, though, suggested a visit to a local shaman, a woman who was 103 years old. I'd love if you could tell us and our listeners about that experience and how she treated you, because I thought it was absolutely fascinating the results she was able to get in such short order.
You're absolutely right. It was amazing, and I remember it clearly to this day. As you said, the arm had swollen up between my wristwatch and my elbow. I hadn't fallen off a horse. I hadn't been bitten by a tick. It had just swollen. And I'm a tea drinker. Probably from my accent, you might realize that. I'm born in Kenya, where they grow a lot of tea. Mm. And my wife being born in India. So, there we are.
Yeah.
It's very sore. I can't function. You're right about not being able to hold my bowl of tea. They serve tea in bowls there. Mm. So our translator, Bayamba, took me to Soyan, who's 103, in her teepee structure. She's living on her own. And in that culture, you can't point your feet at anybody. Absolutely not on. And I'd had serious problems with a knee. I'd had to have some surgery on it. So I couldn't bend my knee and squat. Mm. Never mind the fact that I was 60-something at the time. This lady with white cataracts, not just a minor cataract, but actually the whole eye was white. She couldn't see a darn thing, but she could obviously hear really well. Mm. After I struggled for a moment, she said, if that man has a bad knee, it doesn't matter. He can sit down with his knee pointed, his leg pointed.
So, crazy. To be so tuned in.
Absolutely. Well, I guess a lot of people, when they've lost their sight or never had sight, are totally tuned in with a hearing. They have to be.
Mm. Yeah.
So we talk a bit for about my arm, and she says, well, come over and sit next to me. And I'm on the opposite side of the teepee, so I'm more than 10 feet, maybe 18 feet away from her. And I go over, and she palpates my arm. She runs her arm up and down it, not for very long, and she asks a couple of questions from Bayamba, and then she reaches behind me, behind herself, and pulls out this great big leaf. It's probably a foot long and 9 or 10 inches wide. It's a fleshy leaf, fleshier than a cabbage leaf. It's, you can sort of squash it. And says, right, wrap this, heat it up on a stove and wrap your arm in it. Heat it up 3 or 4 times during the night and see what happens. Well, being a veterinarian, I had some banding material, so it made it a lot easier. It wouldn't fall off. So we put it on the stove, wrapped it around the arm, put the bandage on, lovely purple color. You'll see the photographs actually in the book. There are 62 photos in this book, which is delightful.
They were wonderful.
We loved it. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I wrap this stuff, and 2 or 3 times during the night, I wake up and we put the leaf back on the stove and wrap it again. By morning, the swelling's gone. Amazing.
Yeah.
And no pain. I could pick up my bowl of tea again, very important in my life.
Yeah.
And so I say to Bayamba, let's go back and thank the old lady. We do. And because I guess the link with the families, my wife's a physician, my son's a physician, I'm a veterinarian. Turns out Soyan, this old lady, is a shaman, her daughter is a shaman, and her grandson is one of our veterinary technicians. You've just referred to his name, Gamba.
Mm-hmm.
So we have very similar families. Two medical folks and a veterinary person, a man in both cases.
Yeah.
She was delighted with that story, I think. Certainly Bayamba was amazed. So we go, and she lets me sit next to her, and Bayamba takes a photograph.
That's quite an honor.
Oh, something else. And sadly, 103, she died that winter. So that may be the last photograph ever taken of her. We don't know.
Mm. Wow. The alignment there is incredible.
Isn't it just?
Yeah. It's really wild. And just that the fact that that treatment worked so quickly and worked so effectively. We are so used to pills and ointments and incredibly processed medication. And for her to take this to take, you know, one look at you and know what natural remedy would provide such an efficient solution. It's incredible wisdom on her part.
Fantastic. There's an extra literary adjunct to that, which I was got quite disturbed about later. I was lecturing on that story to my veterinary students, and one of them, who clearly wasn't thinking, said from the back of the room, "You mean you equate her to a doctor?" Looked at him for a moment, and I said, "We're in a culture where, yes, she's the doctor. She's the important, and her daughter. There are vitally important medical people in that culture." I think I silenced him.
Sounds like it.
The sad thing is that all these indigenous cultures, I mean, they're slowly kind of, they're leaving our earth with every day. And, you know, these are the people that honor our earth, honor our animals, honor our plants. And a lot of them have oral traditions, or they have these shamanic traditions that my fear is that once they're gone, who today is going to keep those traditions alive?
I fully agree with you. And if we think of one really spooky example that's going on in Brazil right now, what drugs they've developed in those forests, we don't know. The cultures are being destroyed by that Bolsonaro, again, I can't use the right word.
Yeah, I was to say character.
That's okay. That's a safe term. And what antibiotics, what fever-reducing drugs are in those forests that will never be developed? Because there's no margin. Them in some high-profile commercial lab, they can't even, you know, be a waste of time. And they'd lose money. But like I say, Jim, that, boy, we are losing stuff.
Yeah, that's why it's important to talk about their cultures and talk about the powers that they have so that we can at least keep their oral tradition alive and at least keep some of their spirit alive within us and our future generations, because we owe it to them. I mean, we owe it to our ancestors and we owe it to our future descendants.
You're right. And at the same time, languages are being lost.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a story. Well, on that topic, Jerry, you know, the shamans obviously have an incredible oral tradition. They're incredible storytellers. I saw on LinkedIn that you've been a member of the Storytellers of Canada since 1975. It's a very long time to be part of that organization. We always like to have our guests come on and share what secrets they've cultivated over the course of their lives with our listeners. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what advice can you give us about how to tell better stories?
Oh, wow. Put yourself in the story, even if it's a folk story. Go slowly. Don't rush. Don't talk too fast. Let the people take in. And if you can manage it, make them believe that it's real, even if it's a folk story. My stories, because of my background and history, I can tell real stories. And sometimes I like to link the folk story with reality and switch over and not even let the audience realize where the switch has occurred.
Oh, interesting.
There are amazing storytellers who can mesmerize you, you know, even if it's a folk story. Our guild has people, oh boy, you know, you can't help yourself but listen and smile or weep or whatever emotion it is. And if you don't put that emotion into your own story that you're telling, the audience won't believe you either. They won't. There's a really good example of that in our recent lives that we're all dealing with. Zoom. If you're in front of an audience, you can tell and react. You can shoot body movement. Now, you can see my hands on the screen, but your listeners won't be able to see that. And I'm just showing an example. If you want to show antlers, for instance,
right.
You can put your hands on your head. But on a Zoom, you can't.
Because
you can't show the body and can't react to the audience. I got really burned one day. I had to react really quickly. I was storytelling in the high end of the Yukon near the Alaskan border in a very small community called Burwash Landing, total population about 94. Told it would be an adult audience. So I walk into the room where we're doing it, and there are preschoolers on the ground. What are you going to do? There are grannies and great grannies there as well.
Right.
You tell to the kids, and grannies will love it. Try to tell to the grannies, the kids will be fidgeting in 3 minutes flat.
And that's so interesting.
And then the grannies will be distracted anyway, right?
So, yeah, totally.
Yeah, right.
Have you ever heard of the Fisher Kincaid grading scale?
No.
Well, it's like it's a grading scale that where you can put content through, and it will show you at what grade level it's been written. And it's interesting that you say that you know that you want to speak to the child, because if you put in, you know, Hemingway's work will give you like a third grade level of reading ease. In other words, he figured out how to take something and make it so simple that it was as if you're talking to a third grade level. So I think in terms of the storytelling tips, it's like, instead of making things complicated where even a PhD can't understand it, you want to be able to ease what that person is taking in. And so, yeah, that Fisher Kincaid grade scale is something to think about or consider.
Fascinating. I'd never heard of it. I must look it up. When we're done here, I'll go into my Google app or whatever it is, and Fisher, presumably like a guy like me who likes to catch fish.
I'm gonna get you the. I'm sorry, it's Flesh Kincaid. So I knew it wasn't sounding right. It's Flesh Kincaid. FLESCH Okay. Kincaid. Yeah. Sorry, that's a tool of readability, and goes to your point.
I was living in Boston maybe 9 or so years ago now. And one night I was moving out of my apartment, and I think some other people were moving out as well. And they left a stack of books on this little stoop out front. And on the top of this stack was a very small, thin book of African folktales. I was like, I got nothing to do tonight. As I'm waiting for the movers to come, like, I may as well just crack open this book and read a few of these stories. And to your point, Arjun, about simplicity, all the stories are incredibly short. The characters are simple. They're very easy to read. And they're obviously very mythic in nature, but they do pull you in. Like, you can't start one of those stories without having to get to the end. So I think that's a testament to simplicity and again, kind of directing your message to someone who's younger, or at least, you know, younger in spirit.
Yeah, we can enjoy those as adults. Whereas the kids, you try to lay on some technical detail, like we were talking about earlier, about the rise and fall of testosterone.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, one last question I wanted to ask you, Jerry. I observed reading your book that you're something of a foodie. There were lots of descriptions of food in your book. I know you had a very bad experience with that Mongolian noodle dish that we don't have to get into, but I'm curious, like, of all the exotic foods that you've eaten over the course of your travels, was there a particularly positive experience you had trying a new food for the first time?
Well, I guess meeting my Dutch India-born wife, I've learned quite a bit about curry. And I expect that one of you two knows a bit about curry as well. Wonderful curries that you get in India that bear no relationship to what you get in England or Canada. They're a whole different world, and they're so cleverly blended. And Indian curries use the same spices as curries in Malaysia or Indonesia, exactly the same spices, producing different tastes because of the ratios. So I think curry is one of our, we have curry at least once a week in this house, sometimes more, because it's just such a wonderful food source.
That sounds good to me.
So going back to your book and maybe the storytelling aspect, could you share some stories as it relates to some of the work that you ended up actually doing? I know you went and had to deal with inbreeding situations. You had to deal with a number of diseases. What can you tell us about some of the diseases that you were working on, some of the outcomes, and that whole inbreeding situation that you were working on?
I guess so. In the reindeer stories, there were a few situations, one of which was pretty sad. They put saddles on these animals, obviously, and they don't always fit very well. And so they cause terrific damage on the spine. And trying to figure out why and how and what to do about it could be complicated and sometimes not a very good outcome. And dealing with those, occasionally you could help them with advice, changing the saddles and what have you, but not always. And then you had this really difficult problem of telling a herder who only has her livelihood and maybe 23 animals or 40 animals in her entire life, that this ain't going to work. And that becomes, yeah. It's an emotional thing for you. It was amazing with this one lady that she sort of accepted it because I guess my translator picked up my feelings about the situation and passed it on to her in the same vein. And so she accepted it. And I met her the following year, same lady, milking her reindeer again, not the one that I'd had to suggest she couldn't cure. And she was good with it. She just sort of thanked me and said, well, you know, that's life. And she wasn't at all upset. So that was a great feeling that somehow Biamba had managed to relay my feelings onto her. Her name was Erdenchimik. I'm not sure that's the right pronunciation, but that's how you spell it.
Got it.
But the disease you were working on was brucellosis?
That's right. Yep. That's a different situation. That wasn't this one about the damage with the saddles.
Oh.
Yeah. That's a very ugly disease. It can be picked. Lots of species have it. Polar bears have known to have it. Whales, all sorts. But in cattle, it's a major problem because it's transmitted to humans through the milk. And I had an aunt of mine who drank unpasteurized milk. If you pasteurize it, you kill the bacteria. She drank unpasteurized milk. This is many moons ago, of course, all her life. And she had several miscarriages. She had one baby that lived less than a day. And luckily, happily, two of my cousins are fine and dandy. They're similar age to me, of course. But Aunt Joan, she got terrible arthritis. And there were Satan people in the same situation. One so badly affected, she couldn't live in the mountains anymore. They couldn't treat her. Her arthritis had gone. And I know of one veterinarian in Britain who got the Brucella organism and damn near killed him in his heart. Of course, it's a very nasty bacterium and doesn't sit at the top of WHO horrors like Ebola and what have you, but it certainly has to be on the second tier, in my opinion. It does nasty things. Abortion is quite a common incidence. That's how Aunt Joan lost her babies. Through miscarriage, as we call it in humans. But it's actually abortion. It comes to the same thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, our listeners will certainly have to pick up the book to learn about what you were able to do with those diseases once you confronted them. It's really fascinating work. All of us are familiar with the work of veterinarians, but I think wildlife veterinary work is perhaps even more dynamic.
Another part of the book that was so fascinating was the predator problems. Like, can we briefly talk about the role of bears as reindeer predators? What I've read was that they are complete savages. So if you can shine light on what bears are relative to reindeers, that'd be great. And then the other one was wolverines. There was an interesting story of you found a wolverine, or you heard of a story where a wolverine killed a big bull and then actually was living inside the carcass.
Exactly. Full board and lodging.
Yeah. I was thinking Revenant style, like the movie.
Yeah, there you go. Bears could have no trouble catching a reindeer calf. For the first month of the life, the reindeer calf can't outrun a bear. But a bear can only do 60 kilometers an hour. What's that, 35 or something miles for a short distance, and then it wears out. And at a month old, a reindeer calf can outrun a bear. So that's not a problem. But of course, if a bear swipes a reindeer calf, it's done and dusted. You mentioned the wolverine. They're extraordinary. I use the term furred chainsaw. They will chase off a bear. They're only, 70 pounds, a really big one. And bears don't want to mess with them. Don't muck around with me. And the way they kill reindeer is extraordinary. There's even an amazing piece of footage of this that I refer to as a YouTube footage that a Finnish woman took. where a wolverine runs up behind the reindeer, jumps up on its back, runs along the back, and severs the tendons in the back of the neck. So the reindeer can no longer hold its head up. So it drops its head. Of course, it then stumbles, can't function. And then the wolverine may kill it then, or may say, "Ah, I'll just watch you die." Well, not quite. That's not quite the words I use, but that's what he means. Yeah. And he's a member of the weasel family. Weasels are known, if they get in a chicken coop, not to just kill the one chicken they want to eat, but go in a sort of blood-soaked frenzy and kill them all. That family is quite well known for being pretty tough bananas. You could almost call any of them furred chainsaws.
That's crazy. Just one thing on bears from the book that I think is worth reading. You said bears have been shown to be responsible for at least half of early calf mortality on studied ranges. Yeah. And the other thing that you mentioned was there was a recent study of 7 camera collared brown bears in Alaska that showed that they were killing on average about 16 moose and 14 caribou calves per bear per year.
Exactly. And yet there's this great move to kill wolves all over our continent.
Right.
The latest thing I heard on the radio this morning was Wisconsin. There's a huge open wolf cull going on right now. And unfortunately, everybody says wolves are to blame for killing caribou. They've completely forgotten that bears are darn near as efficient.
Yeah.
And yet the wolf gets all the blame. But of course, from Red Riding Hood and the Three Little Piggies and everything, wolves are the bad guys.
Yeah.
So we in our human psyche blame the wolf for just about anything you can think of.
Yeah, it's kind of a projection.
But the bear will do just as good a job.
Interesting. Well, I certainly don't want to cross paths with most any of those animals. But actually, ending on a kind of a lighter note, I enjoyed that little anecdote that you mentioned a client of yours that lived near Saskatoon that would go on regular bike rides on their family farm, accompanied by a dog on one side and her reindeer on the other. Neither of them were leashed. I thought that was quite an image.
Yeah, and actually, she gave me a photograph, which we've got coming in the book. Because the photography section of the publishers, this was an old clip from a movie, and she sent me this one image cut from this movie, and the skill of the publishers, especially in photography, turned that into an image which is in the book about domestication. It's incredible. Mm. They're on a family farm, her mother is going for a bike ride, and the reindeer's on one side, the dog's on the other side, there's no leashes anywhere, they're just going for a nice afternoon stroll.
That is definitely an example of domestication at work. One final question we have for you, Jerry, which we've been asking all of our guests: if you could be any animal for a day, what would you be and why?
Oh, my, I never saw that question coming.
You can't say rhino because you said that at the beginning of the episode.
Well, you'd have to be very careful about not being wildlife because it's all being hammered and poached.
Mm. Oh, no one said that before. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Worldwide. I guess a pet dog who's being looked after by a nice family. Mm. That'd be fine. You know, I'd like to be a retriever, actually, because I'm a keen hunter.
Mm.
If somebody got a nice duck or whatever, I'd like to go and fetch it and bring it back and hand it to that hunter and we both feel good.
That's a good answer. And you like water too. I know retrievers have an affinity for water. Well, the book is Reindeer Reflections, Lessons from an Ancient Culture. It comes out on October 1st. There's a ton of interesting information there around reindeers and some very fascinating stories from Jerry's travels overseas that we weren't able to get to, but you'll have to buy the book to hear more. Jerry, it was really a pleasure speaking with you today. We had a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And please mention the wonderful publishers, Rocky Mountain Books.
Absolutely.
Vancouver Island. They've been absolutely fantastic. Wonderful group of people to work with.
Yeah, we've really enjoyed working with them.
Not only are they wonderful, but everyone that we've worked with has been wonderful, and every guest has been incredible. So Jerry, thank you as well for your presence. I thought it was fascinating to have someone like you, because people around the world need to know that people like you exist. And I was, you know, and when I was reading your book, I'm like thinking to myself, like, you know, there are people out here that are like taking care of kids or working their 9 to 5 or worried about scheduling a bunch of meetings. But then there's people like you who are actually trying to, like, you know, cross pollinate Canadian caribou and Mongolian reindeer and things like that. And I'm like, this is just fascinating that people like you exist.
Well, thank you. There's so many wildlife veterinarians working around today. There are two terrific organizations, Wildlife Disease Association and the Zoo and Wildlife Group that I've been a member of. And remember, we're not all dog and cat and horse veterinarians. There's a large and growing number of people who work in exactly this field. And I think that's an important issue.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, people can carve their own life. People can go pursue things that are interesting to them. And so you don't have to be stuck behind in your cubicle or behind your desk. Like, go do something if you want to.
Brilliant. Yeah, you've got it dead on.
All right, Jerry. Well, thank you for spending some time with us. It was a blast.
Well, for me too. Thank you very much.
Jerry.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can sign up for the Rising Weekly newsletter sent out each week.
Every Friday, we expand on the episode with insights, recommendations, and more.
You can sign up at risinglaterally.com.
Thank you.